Thank you, Brother Simon, and good morning, my beloved brothers and sisters and our dear young people. What a glorious morning it is. Lovely to be with you once again as we now commence our third study under the general theme, Showing the Way, Samuel the Seer. You know, brethren and sisters, young people, this chapter, chapter 4, the issues in this chapter are oh so clear. Shiloh has got to go. The current priesthood as it was then has got to go. The Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh that dwelleth between the cherubims has got to go. Because here was Israel, having shown itself no different to a Gentile nation steeped in its own idolatry. And you know, brothers and sisters, what you find is that no one prays in the next three chapters. No prayer. Israel should have prayed when they lost their 4,000 men. No one prayed. We find, brethren and sisters, that Eli should have prayed when the ark was marched out of the gate, taken out of the holiest of holies and marched down to Aphek. He knew it shouldn't have been there. His heart trembled for the ark as he sat there as a blind man watching. No prayer from Eli. The Philistines should have prayed, brothers and sisters and young people, when their gods toppled, when tumours broke out all over their bodies, when their corn, when their grain, when their harvest was devastated and turned into a dust bowl. No prayer from the land of the Philistines in chapter 5. Phinehas' wife should have prayed. Wonderful words on her lips. The ark is gone. The glory is departed. But no prayer from Phinehas' wife, no matter how remarkable those words were. And the men of Beth Shemesh should have prayed, brothers and sisters. When the ark came back, led by two cows, came into the field of Joshua, the Bethshemite, by a great stone. They were amazed. They were rejoiceful. They never prayed. Couldn't wait to get rid of the ark like the Philistines. No prayer in the next three chapters because Samuel isn't there. And when chapter 7 bursts on the scene, in comes Samuel in chapter 7, and there you have it, in comes prayer. So brothers and sisters and young people, this morning what we want to talk about is where God really is. We want to talk about how easy it is for us in this life to allow externals in our worship to get in the way of our personal relationship with God. You know, years ago, a brother gave to me an article and it was called The Activity Trap. And what the article did was to lay out the dangers of large corporate organisations who had a mission statement clearly laid out. That's our goal. That's our objective. And the great industries and great companies would set up all of these activities. They would set up all these procedures, put them in place in order to assist the employees to achieve the company goal. This is where you get the red tape. This is where you get the bureaucracy getting in the way. And the problem is, as the article outlined, is that all of these activities that were designed to allow the persons to reach the goal, the activities kept getting in the way. The activities became the end in itself and not the means to an end. And the article went on to say that religious organisations are particularly vulnerable to this kind of activity trap. And he painted a little picture of a child who got up in the middle of the night and went to the bathroom. And when the child came back, his bed was made. So what had happened is that the mother had gotten so used to making the bed that the bed was only there to make, not to be untidy, not to sleep in. And that, brothers and sisters, is what happened to Israel, and that can happen to us. We've got wonderful activities. Glenlock is a wonderful activity. Youth group activities are wonderful. Bible classes are wonderful. But they're all a means to an end. And we ought not to get so involved in that activity and make that our goal, that our rest, that our aspiration. It's a means to get us to becoming like God and eventually, God willing, to be in the kingdom. And this is the tragedy of this fourth chapter, and it serves to highlight, brothers and sisters, just how morally degenerate and how weak God's people had become. 40 years of Eli's feeble priesthoodship did not help one bit. And so the Philistines in chapter 4 are going to capitalize on this issue. They're going to take advantage of a nation that was besieged with internal jealousy and lust. But no move on God's part was going to take place. God was not even going to attempt to free this nation until a national, pure religion was restored. Until men and women were committed to God. Not a piece of furniture, not a lucky charm, committed to God. And therefore, brothers and sisters and young people, we'll read in verse 1 of 1 Samuel chapter 4. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out against the Philistines to battle and pitched beside Ebenezer, and the Philistines pitched in Aphek. Do you know, the first part of this verse really belongs to the end of chapter 3. So what you would read in verse 21 of chapter 3 is this. Yahweh appeared again in Shiloh, for Yahweh revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh by the word of Yahweh, and the word of Samuel came to all Israel. That's how it should read, and therefore that first sentence in chapter 4 belongs at the end of chapter 3. And so what we have, therefore, brothers and sisters, God speaking to Samuel in Shiloh, and in turn Samuel will convey the word of the God to the nation. Take away that first sentence, however, out of chapter 4, and it still appears that Israel initiated the fight. There's no suggestion as to why Israel would even attempt to do this. On the contrary, you come back with me, if you will, to Judges 15. Israel didn't initiate the fight, brothers and sisters. This is what they were like with respect to the Philistines. Judges chapter 15. This is their attitude to the nation that harassed them for all these years. Judges 15 and verse 9. Time of Samson, who, by the way, was contemporary with Samuel. So Samson's running around doing his thing, and Samuel is doing his thing. As one brother said, Samuel was out there doing the heavy work, and Samuel was reaching to the hearts. He was reaching to the hearts of men and women. Well, here in verse 9, then the Philistines went up and pitched in Judah and spread themselves in Lehi. And the men of Judah said, "Why are you come up against us?" And they answered, "To bind Samson are we come up, to do to him as he hath done to us." So you see here, brothers and sisters, in verse 9, the Philistines went up and pitched in Judah. Well, then verse 11, then 3,000 men of Judah went to the top of the rock Etam and said to Samson, "What are you doing? What is going on? Knowest thou not that the Philistines are rulers over us? What is this that you've done to us?" And he said unto them, "As they did to me, so have I done to them." And so the men of Judah are remonstrating with Samson, and they're saying to Samson, "Just leave us in peace. Don't stir the Philistines up. They are our rulers." And so therefore, brothers and sisters, when you come to 1 Samuel chapter 4, I don't believe Israel initiated any fight here at all. What happened was, here was the Philistines who had marched up from their territory, and they're now camped at Aphek. Now, Aphek is 30 kilometres or thereabouts north of Ekron. And Ekron was the northern of the five towns of the Philistines. So the Philistines have pushed themselves 30 kilometres to the north. Not only so, but if you were in Aphek and you swung around to the east, 30 kilometres over there in the east is Shiloh. So if you're in Shiloh looking to the west, down in the foothills, there's Aphek, and there's where the Philistines are. So 30 k's up from Ekron and 30 kilometres across from Shiloh. Oh, this is a clear demonstration that the Philistines moved up and down that land with impunity. This is a clear declaration, brothers and sisters, that the Philistines are there to intimidate and to threaten Shiloh, the sanctuary at Shiloh. And therefore, when you read the Septuagint of verse 1 of chapter 4, this is what you would read. Listen to these words. Verse 1, Septuagint, chapter 4. "And it came to pass in those days that the Philistines gathered themselves together against Israel to war. And Israel went out to meet them and encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek. Brothers and sisters and young people, they're out there, are the Israelites. They're going out there to protect their sanctuary. And you can't do that if your heart's not right. They're going to war, and that's not going to work for them either. Because you can't go to war against the enemy if you don't know where you are. And they did not know where they were. Philistines did. Record says Israel pitched at Ebenezer, and the Philistines pitched at Aphek, brothers and sisters. Israel pitched in a place that Samuel would not name for another 20 years. In 1 Samuel chapter 7, 20 years later, Samuel's going to call that place the Stone of Hell. And that place is only going to help them if they gave their heart to God. And they're not going to do that. They're not going to remove the Baals. They're not going to remove the Ashtaroths out of their heart for another 20 years, brothers and sisters. And therefore, here we are in chapter 4, and Israel come along and they pitch their tents in a place that had zero meaning to them because the place had no name. And by the way, the ignorance of what this place should have meant to them had actually been prophesied 450 years before this event. You come with me back again to Deuteronomy 32. Already been here when we talked about Eli. Why are you kicking at my sacrifices? Why are you gorging yourself? Why are you made thick? Why are you fattening yourself? Well, when you come back to Deuteronomy 32 again, you've got this prophecy 450 years later from Deuteronomy 32, Israel would pitch in a place they had no idea where they were. How can you go to war when you don't know where you are? How can you protect a sanctuary when you haven't got the right heart? Well, here's the prophecy, verse 18, Deuteronomy 32. Of the rock that begat thee, the stone of help. Wouldn't be named that until chapter 7 of 1 Samuel. Of the rock that begat thee, thou art unmindful, and hast forgotten God that formed thee. The Hebrew, forgotten, is the word which means to mislay. They couldn't find him. They didn't know where he was. They had mislaid God. They thought God was in a golden box. And who, brothers and sisters, was there to teach them? Who were there among the leaders to teach them where God really was? Oh, he's in the box. You have a look over in verse 28 through verse 31 of Deuteronomy 32. No one was there to teach them. That's what it says in verse 28 of Deuteronomy 32. For they are a nation void of counsel. Neither is there any understanding in them. Oh, that they were wise, that they understood this, that they would consider their latter end, and how that one could chase 1,000. How can two put 10,000 to flight? How can one Philistine chase 1,000 Jews? How can that happen? Except God sold them. If they had God on their side and they knew where they were, and they knew where God was, God wouldn't allow one to chase 1,000. He wouldn't have allowed them to be routed, except God had shut them up. Verse 31, for their rock. Oh, brothers and sisters, when you read verse 28 through verse 30, the Philistines would never have routed Israel if God hadn't sold them, but he did. And in the end, it was the enemy that acknowledged that their God was no match for Israel's rock. The Philistines said that. We can't compete against Israel's God. And they sent the ark back to the Philistines, humbled, and Dagon laying flat on his face. Therefore, verse 31, listen to this from the Philistines' mouths. For their rock is not as our rock. Even our enemies themselves are judges and testimony to that very fact, brothers and sisters. So Israel didn't know where they were. They hadn't been taught because the leaders didn't themselves understand. Oh, the Philistines, different thing altogether. The Philistines, these fellows, brothers and sisters and young people, knew exactly where they were. They had camped at Aphek. And Aphek in the Hebrew means restrained. It's got the idea of strength through abstinence. To the Philistines, the place that they pitched their tent meant discipline. It meant discipline in war. And by the way, Aphek also means a fortress. And I want you to keep that in mind for our study tonight. Because the Philistines are at a fortress, and then they're going to take the ark to another fortress, which was Ashdod. And you see what God does in chapter 5 to a fortress with the people of the Philistines. But for now, the Philistines think they've got it all made. They're not confused. They're not ignorant. That place meant something to them, brothers and sisters and young people, and they were determined to make Aphek real in their lives. And therefore, you read verse 2 of 1 Samuel 4, these words. And the Philistines put themselves in array against Israel. When they joined battle, Israel was smitten before the Philistines, and they slew of the army in the field about 4,000 men. Now that expression there in verse 2, the first sentence, the Philistines put themselves in array against Israel, is a statement that springs directly from the word Aphek. And it really shows their confidence in the place. It shows their knowledge of the place. It shows their determination to make the meaning of Aphek real. Because the word array there is a word which means to set in order, to set in a row. Israel didn't do that. The Philistines did it. It was one army only, and that was the Philistine army that set themselves in a row. Fellas, you stand there. You go over there. You go there. Got it? You make sure you're there. They're all disciplined. They're all ready. They know exactly what it's about. Because brothers and sisters and young people, they had a belief in a cause. And because only one side had a belief in a cause, when the battle was joined, or spread as it is in the Hebrew, Israel were pushed and pushed, and 4,000 men perished. Jesus Christ said to us in Luke 16 and verse 8, that the children of this world are wiser in their generation than the children of light. The children in this world, brothers and sisters, know exactly what they want, and they will make every sacrifice they can to get what they want. In that sense, they are wiser, much wiser than the children of light. Our Lord Jesus Christ said that, brothers and sisters. And therefore, one army is prepared to do something that the other army... Well, you know, try living in this world without knowing where God is. Try, brothers and sisters, living in this world and not understanding where we pitch our tent. Try to go to war with the enemy and we'll fail every time. We'll be overrun by an army who knows exactly what they're about. Well, when 4,000 men were destroyed, the elders cried in verse 3, "Why have we lost? What's happened to us? Why have we lost?" That's a good question. But here's some better ones. Why are worshippers turning up at Shiloh drunk? And why are women being seduced at the door of the tent? And why is corruption and violence tolerated in Shiloh in the tabernacle? And what's more, why are we out here fighting to protect brutality and lust? They're better questions that the leaders should have been asking than why have we lost? And the answer simply was no leadership. And now instead of calling on God and instead of falling on their knees, brothers and sisters, and resolving to pray, they start arguing with God. They start quarrelling with him. They're not happy with what God's done. They're disputing with God and they're doing it boldly. Plain fact of the matter was that Israel had sinned and they weren't willing to see it. They weren't willing to own up to what they've done. It's not what we've done, it's what God's done. Never mind what we've been up to. In fact, the summary of those actions, brothers and sisters, is summed up really in Proverbs 19 and verse 3, where it says there in Proverbs 19 and verse 3 that a man's folly ruins his life, yet his heart rages against Yahweh. And that's exactly what these men were doing. And they're confused. They're confused. And some of them in the camp of Israel are afraid. And some are angry, but all of them are very, very ignorant. And then somebody pipes up from the group and says, I know what the problem is. I know why God has given us up. And somebody else said, well, what's the problem? What's the answer? I know he isn't here. Who? Yahweh, where is he? He's 30 kilometres away. He's back in Shiloh. We've left God back there. That's our problem. Brothers and sisters, that's absolutely ridiculous. That's stupid in all its glory. Stupid to say that God's 30 kilometres away. Is it? How many times, brethren and sisters and young people, do we leave God back at the ecclesial hall? How many times do we shake brethren's hands, smile and say all the right things, and we get in our car and we get home and we talk badly to our partner, our husband or our wife, and get angry because something's happened to the car or the caravan or whatever it is? Or go somewhere that afternoon after the memorial meeting, a place we might go that we would not be happy to take the Lord Jesus Christ. Or watch something perhaps on the afternoon after the memorial meeting that we'd feel uncomfortable if Jesus sat next to us. Is that not leaving God back 15, 20, 30 kilometres away? And here they were. And they thought like that, brethren and sisters, because their life was all about them. Them. Therefore, you read in 1 Samuel 4 and verse 3, it says there, listen to them. It's all about me. They're able to leave God 20 kilometres away and get on with their own life and then bring God back when they need him. Therefore, you read in verse 3 of 1 Samuel 4, the elders of Israel said, wherefore hath Yahweh smitten us today before the Philistines? Let us take unto us the ark of the covenant of Yahweh out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh to us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies. You leave God conveniently in another room when your life is about you. And that's exactly what they did. And now they're going to get him because they now need him. Didn't need him before when they were doing this, that and the other. Oh, brothers and sisters, they're going to take God out of Shiloh. Just come back to Joshua 18. Look at what they did. They didn't get it. They didn't get what had happened 400 years before. You come back to Joshua 18 and verse 1. Think about Shiloh. What time did we start, by the way? I've got no idea. What time did we start?
4:15.
How much?
About 4:10.
10 o'clock, was it? Yep. It's okay, it's all these different starting times. Very confusing. Somebody's mucking around that clock as well. Now look, Joshua 18 and verse 1. Now the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together at Shiloh. Oh, so there it is. They put the tabernacle at a place of rest. That's what Shiloh means, rest. Joshua did that. You look at the next little statement here in verse 1. And they set up the tabernacle of the congregation, and the land was subdued before them. I wonder, brothers and sisters, the sight of the procession of the ark and the tabernacle, did that strike fear into the inhabitants of the land and remind them of the destruction of Jericho? Interesting little phrase. And the land was subdued before them when they placed the tabernacle and the ark there at Shiloh. But you see, brothers and sisters, the whole ecclesia, as it is in the Septuagint, the whole ecclesia assembled together at Shiloh. Well, you have a look at verse 8 and 10. Now, verse 8 says, and the men arose and went away, and Joshua charged them that went to describe the land, saying, go, walk through the land, describe it, and come again to me, that I may here cast lots for you before Yahweh in Shiloh. Verse 9. And the men went and passed through the land and described it by cities into seven parts in a book, and came again to Joshua to the host at Shiloh. And Joshua cast lots for them in Shiloh. Brothers and sisters, Shiloh was a place to which people came. This tabernacle was placed in the place of rest, and Joshua's place of rest was just a little way from Shiloh. And it's almost like Joshua says, I've taken my rest, the ark and the tabernacle of God has taken its rest. Now you, therefore, the remaining seven tribes, you go up there and complete it. So that was a testimony that you can rest because God is there in Shiloh. Well, then have a look at chapter 22 of Joshua and verse 12. Joshua 22 and verse 12, we read this about the people in Shiloh. This should have been something that rankled in the memory of the people of Israel in the days of Samuel. Verse 12, Joshua 22, and when the children of Israel heard it, heard what? That their brethren set up an altar on the other side of Jordan. Now they're worried that they're not going to come to Shiloh and worship as you should be worshipping in Shiloh. They're getting all huffity. They're getting all uppity about what their brothers are doing on the other side. And when the children of Israel heard it, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered themselves together at Shiloh to go to war against their brethren. But if they didn't have that same zeal to go to war against the enemy, which were the Philistines. But you see, brethren and sisters, were these people so special? Were these people so privileged, Israel, that they could call God out of his place and demand that he come to them? You know, there's a lesson here for you and me. It's a common thing for those who have removed themselves from the imperatives and vitals of religion to discover a great fondness in ritual and external observation. The bottom line is, this people had lost their reverence for God. Think about that. It's wonderful to be a family. It's wonderful to have a ring of happiness when we come together at meetings. It's wonderful to hear brethren greeting each other and hugging each other. It's wonderful to see that. That's fellowship, brethren and sisters. But let's think very seriously when we come on Sunday morning. We come in the presence of Almighty God. Where is the reverence going? There is a time and place to be happy and bubbly and slap each other on the back. Where is the reverence going? Remember who we stand in the presence of, and they had lost it, brethren. They had presumed on the grace of God. How many brethren and sisters turn up at the memorial meeting and tragically that's the only meeting some of our brothers and sisters come to? Sunday Christadelphians is becoming very common. Sunday morning Christadelphians. I used to go to church. We went to church on Sunday. That's all you did. Nothing else. You just go to church on Sunday and you come out clean. And there are too many Christadelphians that just come Sunday morning. How many of us who come, whether it's just Sunday morning or other meetings, and we come to the memorial meeting and we think somehow in some magical way that when the Lord returns, we will be saved? It doesn't work that way, brethren and sisters. It doesn't work that way. Israel had a fiery zeal for the ark, but they treated its substance with contempt. Let's make sure we don't treat our reverence for God and our assembling together when we break bread with contempt. They made an idol of the ark. Do you know what the Philistines used to do when they went into battle? This is true. They used to take little gods, little idols in their pockets. Before they went off to battle, whoops, I've got to grab that one. Whoops, I've got to grab that one. Oh, I might need that little one. Might need that little fellow there. Pop him in that pocket and off they would go. And here's Israel, brothers and sisters. They're taking, oh, I know how we'll beat the Philistines because we know they take little idols in their pockets when they go to work. We'll beat them by a bigger idol. We'll take the ark. That's how they thought. You think about that, brothers and sisters. You think they got it wrong. Well, therefore, in verse 4 of 1 Samuel 4, we read these words. Verse 4, 1 Samuel 4. So the people sent to Shiloh, that they might bring from thence the ark of the covenant of Yahweh of armies, which dwelleth between the cherubim. They took the ark from the place of rest, of peace, and of tranquility, and they placed it in the midst of the fury and heat of battle. And they should never have done that, brothers, in our Eli has got a chance to pray. Israel should have prayed after they'd lost 4,000 men. Now Eli's got a chance to pray. He's there sitting by the post. And there's these two boys. You know, big mouths, big eyes, big stomachs. Out they go and they're carrying the ark straight past him. Eli should have stopped them in their tracks and told his boys to put that art back. But he didn't, brothers and sisters. Now, I want you to note the full title here. There it says there, they then went to get the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh of Armies, which dwelleth between the cherubim. The Ark of the Covenant? And they're saying, by using that expression there, they're saying, how could God not save the covenant people? By using that expression, they're saying, his army, Yahweh of armies, his army is there for that purpose, wasn't it? To save us? And would God allow an uncircumcised nation to dislodge him from between the cherubim? No way! They thought they'd connected all the dots, but they didn't get it. When the ark arrived, brothers and sisters, in the camp, and the camp erupted, there on either side carrying that ark was the clenched fist, the bruiser, and the mouth of the serpent, the mouth of brass. And they're saying, the audacity to say, this is Yahweh of armies that dwelleth between the cherubim, the covenant. And right there, brothers and sisters, there were two men that disgraced the covenant. And they had the temerity to believe that they were walking the same road as Moses. Or they could have hearkened back to their scriptures and said, we're just doing what Moses did. Were they? You come back with me to Numbers chapter 10, verse 35. They could very well have been thinking about this. We're doing the right thing. We're following our leader. And what a great leader Moses was. We're doing what he did with the ark. Well, Numbers 10 and verse 35, we read this, you could be thinking, oh, well, maybe they did. Maybe they did connect the dots correctly. Numbers 10 and verse 35. You could hear them thinking these words. It came to pass when the ark set forth that Moses said, rise up, Yahweh, and let thine enemies be scattered. Well, the only ones that were scattered in 1 Samuel 4 were Israel. The Philistines weren't. So who was the enemy of God? Really? At Aphek, it was Israel. Let thine enemies be scattered. Let them that hate thee flee before thee. The Philistines didn't flee from the ark. Israel did. Let them that hate thee. Oh, brothers and sisters. And when it rested, he said, return, O Yahweh, unto the many thousands of Israel. But the problem was, in verse 33, this is what they didn't get. In verse 33, and they departed from the mount of Yahweh 3 days' journey, and the ark of the covenant of Yahweh went before them in 3 days' journey to search out a resting place for them. There was the ark placed there by Joshua. This is the place of rest. You go and take your place. Now, brothers and sisters and young people, we need to understand the time frame here. Here comes the ark into the camp, and the Israelites, they're over the moon as to the presence now of the ark. But you need to understand the time frame to better appreciate the reaction of the Philistines when the ark turned up. Now, getting the ark into Ebenezer or into Aphek would have been a 2-day process. So to take 1 day for the runner to go up, he's going uphill. It'd take 1 day to get from Aphek back to Shiloh. And then it'd take another day to get the ark from Shiloh back down to Aphek. And for 2 days, the Philistines waited. I mean, they'd already destroyed 4,000 men. They didn't rout Israel. That hadn't happened yet. But for 2 days, the Philistines are waiting. Now, it's like, brothers and sisters, we're here. And down there at lock number 2, you know where lock number 2 is. You can see the lights on the lock in the evening. So here we are, we're the Philistines in this camp here, and Israel are down there just past that lock. And a day goes by, and the Philistines are walking around their camp. They can't hear a peep coming down from the lock. Can't hear a boo. Day 2 goes by. Can't hear a thing. It's all quiet. And some of the young fellas in the Philistine camp would be saying to the admirals or the generals or whoever they had there, they'd be saying, well, why don't we go and finish them off? It's been 2 days. We're itching to get into them. We've got 4,000 notched up on our guns. We want to go in there and get the rest of them. And you can see the old fella standing there saying, you just let them stew in their fear. How much sleep do you reckon over there in the Israelite camp they're getting? They're not getting any sleep. They're insomniacs. They won't sleep at all. They are in absolute fear. Can you hear them laughing? No. Can you hear them cooking their dinner? No, there's not a rattle. They're all quiet. And all of a sudden, brothers and sisters, that was a good strategy. That was psychological warfare, as the Philistines are saying. Just let them stew in fear. And then all of a sudden, verse 5, 1 Samuel chapter, now you understand the reaction. You come to 1 Samuel chapter 4 and verse 5, and when the ark of the covenant of Yahweh came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout that the earth rang again. Could you imagine that? Nearly 3 days of deathly silence, and all of a sudden there's this roar. In fact, the NIV translates verse 5 that all Israel raised such a great shout that the ground shook. In fact, the Hebrew word for great, it means to split the ears. So these armies are so close to each other that the Philistines felt the tremor of the great shout that came from the camp of Israel. Oh, this is Jericho. 3 days or thereabouts of total silence. That's what happened to Jericho. Not 3 days, but total silence. They weren't allowed to say a word, and God gagged their mouths for effect. And then all of a sudden, there's this great roar. This is Jericho, when great big thick walls fell inwards. And you can imagine the Philistines hanging on to everything they could in their sight. But I tell you what, the ground might have shook. It might have been the earth rang again, when it did back there in the times of Jericho, but not even a spoon or a fork in the camp of the Philistines tipped out of a bowl. Nothing fell. But I tell you what, brothers and sisters, as the roar of thousands of voices echoed down that valley and swept into the camp of the Philistines, nothing's fallen. There's still spears hanging up there. The tents have been ripped out of the ground. Nothing's fallen, but there was dread, superstitious dread. Look at verse 8. Woe unto us. Who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. Well, they didn't pass their history exam here, brothers and sisters, and they got a D for geography as well, and their religious studies wasn't tracking too well either. Because when you read that verse, they thought the plagues were in the wilderness. So what they'd done, they'd taken the plagues out of Egypt and put them in the wilderness, did the Philistines. And they thought that the Egyptians were defeated by the ark. So what they've done is they've taken the ark out of the wilderness and put that in Egypt. They've got it all back to front. They're superstitious, they're ignorant, and they're uncircumcised. And guess what? What's different between them and that army over the other side of the lock? Over the other side was Israel, equally as superstitious, equally as ignorant, and equally as uncircumcised. The only difference between those two armies was that one was disciplined. They were men who knew what they were about, and they were determined to make it happen. And therefore you read in verse 9, be strong, quit yourselves like, be men, the Hebrew says, be strong, be men, O ye Philistines, that ye be not servants unto the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Be men and fight. I find this amazing. It's the Apostle Paul, you can see that in your margin, it's the Apostle Paul that actually takes that up and exhorts the Corinthians with that cry, with the cry of the Philistines. And that's amazing. Why would Paul do that? I want you to come back and show you why I think he did it. You come back with me to 1 Corinthians 16. Of all the things Paul could have done, and he's exhorting the Corinthians. I suppose to start with, they were a mob of Philistines anyway. Maybe, I don't know, but that could be the relationship. But when in 1 Corinthians 16, Paul actually quotes, you'll see your margin, he's actually citing 1 Samuel 4. And he says to the Corinthians, be men. Strange thing to take as an example, a war cry of the Philistines. Well, here it is in 1 Corinthians 16, in verse 13. You see your margin? See, it's cited from 1 Samuel 4, verse 9, where Paul says in 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 13, watch ye, stand fast in the faith, be men, just like the Philistines said, in superstitious dread. Now, why did he say that? Look, I think the answer is in verse 14. But before you look at verse 14, just have a look at verse 15. I beseech you, brethren, you know the house of Stephanas, that it is the first fruits of Achaia, and that you have addicted themselves to the ministry of the saints. Then the word addicted there in the Greek is to draw themselves up as soldiers. So they're men, they've drawn themselves up as soldiers. So Paul's got this idea in his mind. But he then says in verse 14, after he says to the Corinthians, be men, like the Philistines, he then says in verse 14, let all your things be done with love. And then he finishes it off in verse 22 and verse 23, with love, with love. So he's got love mixed up with this war cry of the Philistines. You know, this was the big issue in chapter 13 of Corinthians. The big issue in 1 Corinthians 13 was love. And the issue, brothers and sisters, was that the Corinthians were children. Now listen to this. They were children in their captivation of the gifts. They were as ignorant of these spirit gifts, these showy externals, as Israel were of the ark. And they in Corinth, like they in Israel, had removed themselves from the vitals of religion and had a great fondness for externals. You don't believe that? Have a look at 1 Corinthians 12. Just track through for a minute or two Paul's argument. Then you know why he grabs the Philistines as an example by what Israel were doing wrong. You come to 1 Corinthians in chapter 12 before you launch into chapter 13. Well, verse 27, 1 Corinthians 12, you are the body of Christ. You are members in parts. As God hath set some in the ecclesia, first apostles, secondarily prophets, thirdly teachers, after that miracles, then gifts of healing, helps, governments, diversity of tongues. Guess what? Tongue speaking is last on the list. Are all apostles, are all prophets, are all teachers, are all workers of miracles, have all got the gifts of healing? Do all speak in tongues? Again, tongues is last on the list. Now I'll read to you the last verses it should be read. Listen to this. Listen to Paul's exhort to the Corinthians. But you covet the best gifts. You do. And I am going to show you a more excellent way. You see what Paul's saying? You are captivated, Corinthians, by the show of externals. But I'm going to show you a more excellent way. And that excellent way, brothers and sisters, is in verse 1 of chapter 13. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am an echo. I'm an echo. That's the word in the Greek. Or I am a tinkling cymbal. And the word tinkling there is a word which means to wail like a child. I'm an echo. If I don't have love like I should have and I haven't been perfected as a man, I am a child wailing. Oh, look at verse 2. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and I know all knowledge and though I've got all faith that I could remove mountains and if I don't have love, I am no man. No man. That's the word nothing. No man. In fact, that word nothing there is translated no man in verse 2 of chapter 14. He that speaketh in an unknown tongue speaketh unto men, not unto men, but unto God, for no man. Paul says, you're no man. And then, brothers and sisters and young people, have a look at them at verse 11 of chapter 13 of Corinthians. When I was a child, now the Greek is no talk. He's talking about speaking in tongues and they loved it. He says, no talk. When I was a child, there is no talk. So I didn't get worried about speaking in tongues because you can't talk. He said, I spoke as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child, and when I became a man, I put away the externals. I put away what I was captivated about. And therefore, in verse 13, now abide of faith, hope, and love, but these three, the greatest of them, is love. Can you see now why in Corinthians 16 he's talking about love and he brings in this exhortation with respect to the Philistines? And Paul's exhorting them to be different to Israel in the days of Samuel. Set aside your ignorant infatuation for externals and grow up and be men. Understand the cause and fight for it. And what's that? Love God and love your brethren. need, if they'd clung to the invisible God with all their heart, and if they'd rejected the visible idolatry, they would have been invincible, brothers and sisters. But they didn't, and therefore they weren't invincible. And therefore we go back to 1 Samuel chapter 4 and read verses 11 through 12. How's everybody going out there in that sun? You know, I've sat out in those chairs for many years. I know what it's like. Sleepy. I used to wear my sunglasses. Oh, you've got to love Glenlock, don't you? You know, brothers and sisters, 1 Samuel 4 and verses 11 through 12. And so the ark of God was taken. The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were slain. But there ran a man of Benjamin out of the army and came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes rent and with earth. Oh, there's a start. There's a start, brothers and sisters. Well, why didn't that happen when 4,000 were slain? Well, why didn't Israel do that? Why didn't they rent their clothes and put sackcloth on and ashes? Why didn't they do that? Well, this man's only a start. He didn't get very far past this, because when he comes past and speaks to Eli, the last thing on his list is the ark. So he hasn't got it all together yet. But when you read verse 12, there ran a man out of Benjamin, out of the army, and came to Shiloh. Some of us would have this in our margins, some of us wouldn't. The two important words in verse 12 are this: Benjamin and Shiloh. They're the two important words. They're words, if you haven't coloured them in, you should colour in Benjamin and Shiloh. Why should we do that? Well, many of us here know, because the last reference to Benjamin, and it's in the context of Shiloh, was Judges 21, wasn't it? Of course it was Judges 21. We know what happened in Judges 21. Just come back, but I want to show you something you may not have thought about as well. Just come back to Judges 21. This is the last record of Benjamin until you get to 1 Samuel 4. And Benjamin happens to be, in the last recorded incident, happens to be in the context of Shiloh. So you read in verse 1 of Judges 21, "Now the men of Israel had sworn in Mizpah, saying, they shall not any of us give his daughter unto Benjamin to wife." Well, you know the story, the horror of what had happened with the Benjamites, the horror of what had happened with the Levites' concubine. And we know, brothers and sisters, what Israel had done. Israel went to war. They were going to wipe Benjamin out. They were going to wipe Benjamin off the face of the map. And here they are in chapter 21. 11 times Benjamin is referred to in this chapter. And the place in question is Shiloh. Well, of course, verse 6, the children of Israel repented. They were going to wipe Benjamin out for what they'd done, but they start thinking twice about it. They repented them for Benjamin, their brother. And they said, well, it's one tribe going to be cut off from Israel altogether. We better get them wives. So they got 400 wives for them, but it wasn't enough. They'd made a vow that they wouldn't give their daughters to any of the Benjamites. And so they go and get 400 women from somewhere else, but it wasn't enough. And the people in verse 15 repented them for Benjamin because that Yahweh had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. Then the elders of the congregation in verse 16 said, "How shall we do for wives for them that remain, seeing the women are destroyed out of Benjamin?" And they said, "I know, there must be an inheritance for them that escape from Benjamin, that the tribe be not destroyed. What are we going to do?" So they came up with the answer: "We will go to Shiloh." And Shiloh, there's a feast that's held every year. And if you go there, the girls will come out and they'll dance to the music. And while they're dancing to the music, you go and hide in the bushes. And when you're watching them dancing and singing to the music, you run out from the bushes and grab whatever one you want and take her home. That's awful, brothers and sisters. Awful. And it ends in that chapter: "In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes." But I tell you what, I wonder whether you notice this. You just have to listen to this. They've got parties going on in Shiloh where you can go and grab somebody from the bushes. Well, look at verse 19. And they said, "Oh, we're going to go to Shiloh." "Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, Shiloh, I know where that is." "No, Look at verse 19. They said, behold, there's a feast of Yahweh in Shiloh yearly. There's a combined weekend. You know where the combined weekend is? It's been there for a long time, a lot of years. Nobody in Adelaide wouldn't know where the combined weekend was, would they? Well, have a listen to this. They go up yearly to a place on the north side. Now listen, on the north side of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goeth up from Bethel to Shechem. Oh, and by the way, on the south of Labona. They've had to give people directions. They've had to get out a map like a GPS and get the coordinates and say, you don't know where it is. No, I don't. Well, this is where they have the feast. This is the feast of God. I'll give you accurate directions so you can find the place. What an amazing thing, brothers and sisters. Minute directions, because they didn't know where it was. Amazing. And here in 1 Samuel chapter 4, you've got this Benjamite running into the camp, running into Shiloh, and he's now no laughter, no lust, no giggling behind bushes. This man, Benjamite, the next time you read about him, he's running in there, brothers and sisters, with his clothes rent and earth on the top of his head. And he'd fled. Everyone else had fled. They'd gone to their own tent. They'd taken their own report. And there was no place in Israel more concerned than Shiloh. And well they might be, brothers and sisters. All the city cried out in verse 13 of chapter 4. And so they should. Because the ark would never come to this place again. And the Philistines aren't about to push aside their advantage. Now that they've taken and routed the army there at Aphek, the Philistines are now seeing a clear pathway 30 kilometres away to get to Shiloh. Did they take it? Well, you know, 450 years later in Jeremiah's time, time won't allow us to turn this up, but 450 years later in Jeremiah's time, in Jeremiah 7 and verses 12 and 14, God says, you consider what I did to Shiloh. You consider what I did to Shiloh. God said that 450 years later to the people in Jeremiah's day as the Babylonians were going to come down and rout that nation. You think, so Shiloh became a memorial of the devastation that God would bring upon them. You might like to take a note, we won't turn it up, but in Psalm 78, we're going to refer to this one tonight, but in Psalm 78 in verses 60 through 64, God clearly outlines what he did to Shiloh. And I'm going to read to you verse 63 and 64. I won't turn it up, but I'll read to you. You listen to this. This is Psalm 78. Did the Philistines take Shiloh? Listen to verse 63 of Psalm 78. The fire decimated the army and left the young women without husbands. In verse 64, the priests fell by the sword and their widows made no lamentation. You imagine that? There was it in Psalm 78. When the priests fell, who lamented them? You don't hear anything of Hophni's wife. Hophni's wife doesn't say a cracker about her husband, the priest. You're left to wonder at the response of the widow of Phinehas. But even when she makes mention of her husband, she puts him last on the list. Now, when you go to archaeology, did the Philistines take Shiloh or did they just do their thing at Aphek? When you read about archaeology, it's actually generally accepted that the Battle of Aphek took place in 1050 BC. So 1,050 years before Christ, the Battle of Aphek took place here in 1 Samuel 4. And there's strong evidence archaeologically to show that Shiloh was decimated by fire at that same time in the middle of the 11th century. So it appears that the Philistines set their mark on Shiloh. They're 30 k's away and they're on the way. And as the Philistines are marching towards Shiloh, you get a report of Eli's mind. You get a script of the involvement of the two sons in chapter 4. You're even given a summary statement of Phinehas' wife and her response to the disaster. Where's Samuel? You ever thought about that? Where's Samuel? While all this is going on, while they're taking the ark out of the Most Holy, and they're going down to Ebenezer or up down to Aphek. Where's Samuel? You know, brothers and sisters, I'm reckoning that Samuel is about 15 to 17 years of age when the ark got taken. And he's there in Shiloh. Who's left in charge? I mean, Hophni and Phinehas are gone. Eli's gone. Who's left in charge? Who's their brothers and sisters to take the remaining furniture? It's got the remaining furniture in the tabernacle has got to be moved. The Philistines are on their way. We've got to get out the lampstand. We've got to get out the altar of incense. The altar of burnt offering's got to go. The laver's got to go. All the curtains are got to come down. The pegs are got to be pulled out. We've got to get this going. They're only 30 kilometres away. They're out here to devastate this. They got the ark. They're coming back for the rest. And we know that this furniture got divvied out up around the land. And who took it? A little bit there, a little bit there, so the Philistines didn't have one centre to get. And there's two orphans. There's a newborn baby, Ichabod. He's just been born. He's going to look after him. And there's probably, I reckon, a three-year-old, Atub, who was the eldest brother of Ichabod. And Ahitub would become the next high priest. Ahitub is Phinehas's son. He's about three. There's a newborn baby. Who's going to look after them? Who's going to take control? Who's going to pull it together? It doesn't take a lot of imagination, brothers and sisters, to see a teenager, Samuel, falling on his knees in prayer and then getting up and directing the events in a way that would mark him out as a man of clear decision in times of crisis. 15. I kind of like to picture in my mind, poetic license, call it as you will, I like to picture in my mind, brothers and sisters, Samuel, 15 or 17 years old, walking up to Ramah, holding on to a three-year-old, Ahitub, and a little baby in his arms, Ichabod. Did Hannah look after them? Did he take them to Ramah? Who did? They had to be cared for. What an amazing thing. A time of crisis, and all the city cried out. Verses 14 to 15 as we bring our study to a conclusion. 1 Samuel 4. All the city cried out. Verse 14. And when Eli heard the noise of the crying, he said, "What meaneth the noise of this tumult?" And the man told, or came in hastily and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old and his eyes were dim that he could not see. Now there are two Hebrew words used with respect to Eli's eyes. In chapter 3 in verse 2, where it said that his eyes waxed dim, the Hebrew word in chapter 3 in verse 2 is a word which means to be feeble or obscure, opaque. But here in chapter 4 and verse 15, you'll note your margin, the Hebrew word is stood. Stood. Eli's sitting down all the time. Everywhere you see him, he's sitting down. The only thing that stood with Eli was his eyes. And that wasn't in a good sense because those eyes, brothers and sisters, were fixed or set. The NIV translates that, whose eyes were set so that he could not see. Rotherham translates it this way, his eyes were fixed so that he could not see. And there, brethren and sisters, was Eli totally blind. The presence of God had departed, and with it went the old man's eyes and the old man's life. What a tragic thing. What a tragic thing. But Eli's tragic death, brothers and sisters and young people, as significant as it was, he fell off the back. So you asked any Sunday school scholar, ask them anything. Ask them to remember any story in the Bible. Falling off the seat backwards and breaking your neck is a story and a picture once heard, never to be forgotten. It's awful, but you never forget it. He broke his neck, and it was tragic. No sacrifice. No bloodletting will purge your house at all. He broke his neck. But as tragic and significant as that was not the center stage of the chapter. Eli's daughter-in-law would leave a greater impression on the reader. She simply said, as she was in her bedchamber, about to give birth, and she heard of the tragedy of the ark, brothers and sisters, and there were those that stood beside her trying to comfort her. Could you imagine that? You're going to be giving birth to a child. I don't want him. But you're going to bring a life into it. I don't want a life. But think about what you could. I don't want to work with that child. I don't want anything. What glory is there for? She called him Ichabod. There is no glory. What glory was there for that newborn babe and his older brother Ahitub? They were both in Eli's house that was doomed. Where was the glory for a dead husband? Where was the glory for the dead high priest? Where was the glory for Israel? There is no glory. God's name and purpose had been profaned by heathen men. And all, brothers and sisters, because God's people didn't know where he was. Of the rock that begat thee, thou art unmindful. And they mislaid the God that had formed them. Do you know, brothers and sisters, all the while that we have been giving this study this morning, all the while, there have been angels sitting over there talking to each other. There were angels over there. See that log over there? All the while through the study, there have been angels sitting on that log, chatting to each other and watching us in here. There have been angels sitting on the riverbank, probably around your campfire. Do you believe that? You better, because it's true. Where's God? He's right next to us. Not in the externals, right next to us. And if we believe that, brethren and sisters, there is glory. And we'll see that, God willing, in our study this evening.